Hello and welcome back to another podcast episode of my podcast, The World's Greatest Podcast. Today we will be talking about eating disorders and body dysmorphia, and I have Dr. Ross here. If you would like to introduce yourselves to ourselves, tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do.
Sure. Okay, so my name's Ross Addison. I'm a child and adolescent CBT therapist, a cognitive behavioral therapy. I also work with some young adults as well. From the UK, moved to Dubai about 10 years ago, work at the clinic called Reverse Psychology, where a team of us just support lots of different members of the community, children, adults, across a range of different mental health concerns, and I suppose most importantly for today, across eating disorders, body dysmorphia, and people that have low self-esteem related to this.
So I really wanted to pull out some statistics, which I'm going to read from my phone. First one is that body dysmorphia disorder is slightly more common among women than among men. Among adults who have body dysmorphia, 80% report having thoughts of suicide and 44% have attempted to end their own lives. It is estimated that 2% of the adult population are living with body dysmorphia. This is around 1 in 50, so 1,075,980 people in the UK. An estimated 9% of the US population, or 28.8 million Americans, will have an eating disorder in their lifetime. 15% of women will suffer from an eating disorder by their 40s or 50s, but only 27 receive any treatment for it. And 10,200 deaths each year are the direct result of an eating disorder, and that is one death every 52 minutes. So I ask my followers on Instagram to send me over some questions to ask you. The first one would be, what causes body dysmorphia generally?
Okay. If you don't mind, I'll just quickly say something about the stats that you mentioned.
Feel free.
I think so. It's certainly true that women report more body dysmorphic or eating disorder type traits, but the guys, they're just not seeking help. They're less inclined to report it or to tell anyone about the struggles that they're having. So what we're actually seeing in reality is a lot more guys as well are really struggling with it than is actually reported in the numbers. But most certainly it's women. You know, that's the gender, and there's a certain age range where it's much more prominent. But in terms of what causes it, so across all of the eating disorders, the different diagnoses we have, and body dysmorphia, the common, I suppose, theme that we always see is low self-esteem. So low self-esteem and low confidence tends to kind of almost be like the underlying backbone of what allows dysmorphic traits or eating disorder traits to start developing. I haven't yet worked with a young person or an adult with an eating disorder or body dysmorphia that doesn't have very low self-esteem. Sometimes it's tricky to know from their side whether the low self-esteem came first or the body dysmorphic traits came first. But certainly low self-esteem, which can come about for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to be bullied about your appearance to develop body dysmorphic traits. As long as that bullying results in your self-esteem going down, you're much more likely to develop any mental health concerns. But should you receive any bullying related to appearance, of course, it's much more likely that that's going to be the area that it really starts to develop. So I would say generally being, predisposed to mental health concerns, whether it's from a family member or maybe a medical condition, makes you more likely to perhaps develop dysmorphic traits. Kind of family dynamics is a big part of it as well. A lot of the research shows that someone with body dysmorphia or eating disorder traits probably has a parent or a family member that's been through or going through the same condition. So it's almost like a little bit learnt. You know, they're exposed to lots more conversations at home about diet, nutrition, what to wear, how to look, and all of those types of traits, especially if there's this predisposition to low self-esteem or low confidence, really make it emerge. So there's a lot of factors that really contribute to it. But when you're looking at the underlying type traits, you know, genetic predisposition is one of the big ones. Family dynamics and structure, what's going on at home. The development of mental health concerns, whether they're related to dysmorphia or they're not, would be much more likely for dysmorphic traits to emerge if there are traits that come up. Exposure.
Exposure.
Social media.
Yes.
You know, it's great in so many ways.
And it's also damaging in so many ways.
It is, unfortunately. You know, I think of the clients that I meet with body dysmorphic traits, they tend to have someone on Instagram who mm-hmm. they kind of mentor, or sorry, who they kind of see as a mentor, one or two people. And they're typically the people that, you know, what we would say is kind of look amazing, you know, have the ideal body goals. Yes. But that's quite dangerous, really, because when you're being exposed to so much of what should a woman look like or what should a man look like, there's a lot of pressure. And I think if we make it more specific to Dubai, you know, we live in a beach community. You know, it's the weather here makes it quite hard for us even to cover up. So I've had a client that came to me in the past, you know, summer months, wearing joggers, a big sweatshirt, really baggy. You know, it was 45 degrees outside, yeah. but felt so uncomfortable that she, you know, wanted to wear these clothes that covered herself up. So living in this kind of community kind of pushes us to be a bit more revealing in what we wear as well. So I think that's a factor, especially here. But social media is a huge, huge part of it.
Huge part. The next question that I have for you, what are the main causes of binge eating?
So the causes, I mean, so again, looking at what would predispose someone to develop a binge eating disorder, I mean, if you move away from things like social media and genetic predisposition, it's a dislike for their body. You know, if you look at the traits of what would make someone begin to binge eat, and you kind of remove the aspect of they've got a binge eating disorder, low self-esteem, low confidence, depression is often quite comorbid in these symptoms. Someone with depression would be perhaps quite likely to feel emptiness and loneliness. And sometimes we use food as a measure of comfort eating or to try and kind of bring some more satisfaction to our body. So you might develop kind of binge eating type traits as a result of low mood and depression as well, where you just begin eating more and more. And then, you know, for it could be for one of thousands of different reasons, you start focusing a lot more on your body mm-hmm. and your appearance. And perhaps there's a few comments from friends or family members as well. And before you know it, your methods of self-evaluation almost become purely about how I look and my appearance. The focus shifts to being almost entirely that. And then you're stuck in this position where, you know, especially with binge eating, you're binge eating, feeling out of control with yes. what you're eating, how much you're eating, a generally poor relationship with food develops, and then you start purging as a way of, you know, restricting weight gain, trying to look the way that you do. So there's so many different factors that result in it. There's not just kind of one or two things that would cause someone to start binge eating, but you would always be looking at confidence and self-esteem as kind of fundamental themes that are running through that develop it. I mean, of course, even a taste for food, being a foodie, you know, I mean, that can be one of the reasons why you might eat that, what we might consider to be an unusually large amount of food. But, you know, that's very kind of objective anyway. What's unusual for one person can be very usual and typical for another. But there's so many different reasons that contribute to binge eating.
So how would you handle an urge to binge eat?
I wish there was like one sentence that I could say that would really help people. But if I'm to think about, if a client asked me that, I mean, there'd be a few different avenues I go down. One would always be one of the first things I try and help clients with is psychoeducation. So understanding what binging is and what binge eating is. So where the urge comes from. So with them, it's unlikely to be an urge, well, at least summertime, unlikely to be an urge of appetite. So they probably aren't that hungry that they need to eat that amount of food that they have, or even at that time. But if they're also purging after eating, of course, you know, their appetite is going to almost come instantly back after they've purged. But managing that urge, I think recognizing that you've got an urge is really, really important. That gives you the awareness mm-hmm. and the opportunity to be able to say, I'm going to try and fight this, or I'm not going to fight it and I'm going to give into it. Distraction is often one of the best things to do. You know, if you have an urge for anything and you deem it to be a bit unhealthy, trying to get your mind off it can be really helpful. It's not that easy, particularly with binge eating. It's much, much more difficult. But for me, it always starts with awareness. Know the triggers of when it's most likely to occur. Try to restrict the amount of times you're in those triggering situations, or develop a plan for when you are triggered, what you're going to do. So I'm going to distract myself with this. I'm going to leave the kitchen. I'm going to leave home. You know, of course, I probably should have said at the start, whilst we're talking about all of these kind of strategies, you know, if you have a binge eating type concern or a body dysmorphia or an eating disorder, I think we'll probably end up talking about it at some point, but in all likelihood, it's probably not going to go away on its own.
Yes.
So getting that mental health support will hopefully be able to help the person be able to manage it much, much better and hopefully get relief in the symptoms. But there are little tricks, and I'm sure we'll talk about them, and tips that people can do just to try and help themselves a bit more. But for me, it's always about identification, awareness, understand the triggers, and have a plan for what you're going to do when the triggers kind of hit.
Taking action, being self-aware and taking action. The next question that I have for you is about body dysmorphia. So what are some of the ways to overcome those intrusive thoughts, help with accepting my body against body dysmorphia? Where does these thoughts and behavior come from? What are the common triggers for body dysmorphia and having very negative thoughts?
So intrusive thoughts are especially common among anxiety conditions anyway, and you could very much say that someone with an eating disorder or body dysmorphia is highly anxious about weight, shape and size, you know, their appearance in general. So for me, I think, you know, where did the triggers come from? It's, again, there's there are just so many different opportunities for something like body dysmorphia to develop and kind of take hold on someone. It's a really tricky situation to be in for an individual.
There's not a general answer because everyone is so different. And what might trigger, for example, my body dysmorphia can be different to what might trigger, let's say, my best friend's body dysmorphia and my best friend's body dysmorphia, or my cousins, or anyone like that. But someone has asked me, how can I lose weight with having a binge eating problem and not counting calories? Now, I would personally say that if you struggle with binge eating, your focus shouldn't be on weight loss. I think you should work on the binge eating first, and then you can always create a calorie deficit in the future and lose body fats and lose some weight. But what would your kind of answer be? What would you say?
I think that's really tricky as well, because when we think about eating disorders, we typically, in our minds, would assume the person is underweight, but that's not always the case.
Yes.
You know, with anorexia, I suppose, you know, from a classification point of view, to meet the diagnosis, someone would have to be medically underweight. But with binge eating, that's not always the case. The person may be, you know, entirely not underweight. So I can understand why they would want to lose weight, you know, in that situation. But of course, doing it safely, you know, so I'm always working with clients thinking about, okay, well, are you under the guidance of a medical practitioner, sometimes even a nutritionist? Because there are times where we would want to lose weight and it's entirely reasonable to be able to do so.
Yeah.
But with binge eating, the big danger is that it's very, very common that there's purging involved as well. And when you're purging after eating, the impact on your body, you know, not just on your heart, but all of your organs, the electrolytes in your body, makes it extremely difficult for your body to recover. So trying to then inadvertently malnourishing yourself by trying to reduce your food intake, mm-hmm. just doesn't help your organs at all. You're absolutely right in that working on the binge eating disorder, the thoughts, the intrusive thoughts that come along with it and the behaviors would be the best approach to take to start with. Once that's been, let's say, mostly worked through, then maybe there is a space to have some weight loss, some targeted weight loss. Again, I would typically be recommending under the guidance of a nutritionist, dietitian, or medical practitioner. But I think, you know, it's not unusual that we look in the mirror often and think, oh, I could lose a little bit.
Never happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really common. And, you know, there may be a question about it a little bit later about the kind of people who are more likely in terms of careers to develop these types of concerns. But for me, weight loss, it should always be safe. It should always be within the remit of, you know, making sure the organs are protected and not going to be damaged as a result of the weight loss. And how to do it is really important. You know, a lot of people, eating disorder or not, will feel that restricting is the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a nutritionist or a dietitian, but in my mind, I always think, well, it's not about I have to eat less. Maybe I just have to eat a little bit differently.
Yes.
And that's, for me, over a long period of time, will probably get me to where I'd want to be, nice and safely. But I think there's a lot of people that, because of a health condition, a mental health condition or otherwise, feels like in life we're often in a bit of a rush. We want things to happen quicker. But I tend to find with weight, that's probably one of the areas you don't want to rush it. You know, I think the recommendation is not to lose more than something like a pound and a half, or maybe like a pound and a half to 3.5 pounds a month maximum. Yes. Whereas someone who perhaps has a binge eating disorder and wants to lose weight, because of the obsessive nature about how they control food and their appearance, would probably be more motivated to lose something like 3 to 4 kilos a month,
yeah.
Maybe even more. Yeah. That might be their target. But it's just not sustainable. I see this time and time again with clients. And again, that's where the education and psychoeducation comes in. If you restrict your diet so much, your body will crave food.
100%.
If it craves it, it's going to be hard to not give in to it. And you're going to end up overeating because your body is so hungry. It's craving sugar. It's craving carbs. It's the same reason why I don't go shopping when I'm hungry.
Never.
I avoid supermarkets.
Never, yeah.
Because, you know, we always will kind of look at things because our blood sugar is low and think, oh yeah, that looks, and I know that's going to taste good. Whereas if you go shopping when you're not hungry, you tend to pick out more of the things that you think you're going to want. And it tends to be less of the simple carb type stuff.
You always crave the most sugary, unhealthiest.
We do.
Yeah. Rarely, rarely ever. I crave fruit and vegetables, but
a lot of people don't.
Though. Yeah, but more often than not. Well,
but,
yeah.
You know, bringing up the fruit aspect, you know, it's got all of the sugar in it, but they're mostly natural sugars,
yeah.
Which is a really, really good way to satisfy your blood sugar.
Sweet tooth, yeah.
Just to top it up a little bit, even a glass of orange juice can take away that, I suppose, that say psychological appetite for something that's a little bit unhealthy. So that would be, I suppose, a little tip that I might recommend. You know, when you're feeling a little bit hungry, as long as you can determine that you're not in fact hungry, have a glass of water. The kind of rule of thumb is if you have a glass of water when you think you're hungry, and not just for eating disorders, but for any,
in general,
you know, just
yes.
In life, if you have a glass of water and you're not hungry afterwards, you're probably dehydrated.
Yeah.
And dehydration can cause that craving for blood, for sugar. But natural fruit, like fruits, amazing way just to give your body the blood sugar. So you skip the foods that, you know, are chocolatey or, you know, donuts
very
or
heavy,
the things that we just...
Fatty, oily,
yeah.
Buttery. I mean, I like croissants too.
Yeah.
The next question would be, what one of my followers asked me, what should I do whenever I hear someone criticizing my body? Because I tend to take everything personally. I would ask if there is a formula that I can use in these situations, how should I respond to them and what should I say to myself?
Okay. So from a very CBT, practical point of view, I would say create a list of all the things you like about yourself.
Mm.
But try to not make a list of things like, okay, I like that I'm sporty. Create a more defined list. So what is it within sports or within those aspects of sports that you like about yourself or that you think you're good at? Like break them down. It will give you more things to add to your list. So when I'm doing this exercise with families or young people, I tend to say we want a list of 30 things and we're not going to stop until we get there.
Yeah.
So when they say, you know, for example, I'm good at university or I'm good at academics, well, that's such a big cluster. Let's break it down and we can probably get 5 positive things out of this. So I always start with, you know, okay, let's create this list of things that you think you're good at, that you like about yourself, particularly with people with concerns about their appearance, I'd probably want to limit the number of things that go on that list that they like about their appearance, you know, because I want to kind of move away from that being the focus and explore other avenues in their life where they can get those other methods of self-evaluation. So creating this list of things that they really like about themselves, it could be appearance. You know, sometimes with people that I'm working with, they say, but I hate everything about my appearance. Mm-hmm. Often that's not true. It can feel that way. And the thought, probably because you've thought it so many times, can feel like, yeah, that's true, I don't like anything. But when I say to people, you know, do you like your fingernails? Do you like your fingers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you like your ears? What about your nose? What about the corners of your eyes? What about the corneas? What about your fringe? You know, what about the texture of your hair? The depth of it? And they're like, oh, well, yeah, I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like it could be anything. You know, what about your feet? Or when you get your toenails painted, do you like them then? So it's often not the case that someone would dislike everything about their body. They will be able to find some things that they can either tolerate or okay, or they might even like. It's okay to put those on the list. But, you know, for this person, there's a big part of me as just a human being that wants to say, try not to listen to what everyone says, mm-hmm. or to what people say to you. There can be a variety of different reasons why someone might want to criticize, and it can be entirely unrelated to you. You know, if you look at a bully, for example, you know, a bully often doesn't believe everything that they're saying, but they have this need, which comes, I would say, mostly from a mental health concern themselves, to try to empower themselves, to make themselves feel a bit better about who they are. And a quick, instant way for them to kind of get that reassurance is to put someone else down. By putting someone else down, it makes them feel like they're better in the regard of what they're sharing. You know, I could spend a long time talking about just bullying behavior and where it comes from, but try not to listen to what everyone says or what people say to you.
Yeah, because they usually project their own insecurities.
Absolutely.
Onto you. The next question is a very good one. How is it best to approach someone if you suspect they might have an eating disorder or body dysmorphia without scaring them or unintentionally creating a worsening of symptoms?
So I think from a professional point of view, the clients that come to me are normally aware that someone has raised this concern with them. But I would probably say upwards of 50% of the people that I meet with that come for suspected eating type concerns don't agree or don't believe that they have them.
Yes.
You know, it's almost like the treatment for grief. So in grief, the first stage of grief is denial. And with eating disorders, body image concerns, body dysmorphia, denial tends to be the first response. I'm not, I just want to be slimmer.
Yeah.
Or I'm not, I just like eating healthy. Or I'm not, I just have a target. So, you know, like if I saw someone in the gym, for example, and I thought this person may be struggling, I'm not sure I would say anything.
I know.
In that situation. You know, the person may already know it, may be receiving treatment for it. And if I bring it up with them, is that going to help them or could it exacerbate the problem? Someone with, you know, heightened sensitivity to their appearance is probably actually most certainly thinking a lot about what other people think of them, how they're perceived. So if I then walk up to that person and say something like, you know, I'm not even sure what I'd say to someone in that kind of setting. Because most likely they're going to take it, because they're already going to feel very insecure about it. They're going to take it quite harshly or negatively.
Yeah.
If it's a friend, I think that's a different matter.
Yeah.
You know, typically we wouldn't walk up to a stranger anyway and bring something up. But if they're in your CrossFit class and you've spoken to them a few times, there might be an opportunity for you to say at the end of the class, if you're having a coffee or a snack or something, to say like, you know, oh, what's like, you know, your goal as a being here? What are you hoping to achieve? That might open up or start opening up some of the conversation. I mean, you'll probably have observations because they perhaps won't be eating when you're eating. Or if they are, they're probably not eating as much. You might have an opportunity to bring up a comment like that.
Mm-hmm.
you know, oh, we just burnt kind of 2,000 yeah. calories we need to eat. Oh, do you, yeah. you know, it looks like you're really slim. No. You know, I mean, you could do it. Again, if it's someone you've got a relationship with, if it was a friend of mine that I thought had developed an eating concern, and a good friend of mine, I'd probably, when the timing is right, so when it's calm, when it's peaceful, when we're alone and it's just us, I'd probably introduce something like, you know, I've been thinking, it looks like you've lost a bit of weight. Is yeah. everything all right? You know, with a close friend, though.
Yeah.
I think yeah. we'd feel much more confident in bringing something up. Like, you know, it's been on my mind. Should I be worried?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could bring some humor into it even, you know, just to open up the conversation. But most likely you'll be faced with denial. Just a brick wall of, oh, everything's fine. I'm just, you know, I've been a bit sick or I've been yeah. a bit ill. They'll yeah. tend to be an excuse. But I think if it's a close friend, I think you can bring it up. If you're coming from the angle of, I don't know, it's been on my yeah. mind. Yeah. yeah, concern. I'm a little bit of worry. I think it might not be necessary for you to say, I think you should go and get help, or I think you should go and see someone. Like, to start with, it's just about exploration, being curious. You know, you just want them to feel like someone else cares, someone else is listening. And, you know, you might even find that person feels like they get more help from you just by being curious than going to see a therapist or a psychologist who's just going to be very practical in their approach. But, you know, someone with low self-esteem might want to talk about their story.
Yeah. I feel like people can often feel really lonely and alone, and they don't feel comfortable to speak out and to reach out for help, or to even mention anything to their best friends, because they might think that their best friend might judge them, or they might think that they're crazy. So they kind of maybe lock themselves at home or in the office or anywhere, and kind of try to fight these, we can call them demons.
Absolutely, they will. I think, look, we live in a society where it is deemed that appearance is very important.
Yeah.
You know, I read an article not that long ago that all qualifications being the same and smiles being the same, the more attractive person is going to get the job. Okay, maybe that's a reality of what we live in. But, you know, I have clients saying to me, yeah, but more attractive people get further in life.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in some ways, it's quite difficult to argue with that, you know. But I wouldn't say that's a rule either. It can't be. You know, it's not a rule that more attractive people get further in life. They might have different goals, or they might be more successful in some areas, but there might be downfalls in other areas. But I think it's the nature of what we live in now, Anna, that we are heightenedly sensitive to appearance and how we look, and we're much more fragile. Perhaps, I mean, not, I wouldn't say so much my generation, but generations now, you know, children that are under the age of 17, they got much more fragile mental health than the generations that came before them, which is why we see generally mental health concerns just on the up. You know, there's been, in the last 10 years or since 2012, there's been an increase of, I mean, across 10 to 17 year olds, of between 130 to 170% of suicides, you know, admissions to hospital because of self-harming behavior. Mental health is on the increase.
Yeah.
And all conditions as well. You would say that eating disorders and body dysmorphic disorder have seen a significant increase since the emergence. And I don't want to, you know, badmouth any apps, but since the emergence of Snapchat, Instagram and TikTok becoming much more commercial, there has to be a relationship. So I think we live in this society where we deem appearance to be more important than we did 30 years ago. I mean, you see that if you look even back at like the 1600s, the type of appearance that was worshipped is very different to the appearances that we deem much more kind of positive now. You know, if you look at the Renaissance art, it was curvy women, you know, that were the people being painted. That's how, you know, the society was of this is what's attractive.
Yeah.
And then now it's, you know, moved very much to slim as possible.
Yeah. Trying to be as thin as possible. Yeah, and as we already mentioned, I love social media and I love being on social media and helping other people, but it also can be very damaging and detrimental to your health, to your mental health, both mental and physical,
mm-hmm.
because it can damage your mental health, which can then, if it damages you in terms of an eating disorder or binge eating, then that also damages your physical health.
You'd asked earlier, Anna, one of your subscribers or colleagues had mentioned about what to do if someone criticizes,
yes,
or puts you down, you know, on social media. And again, not to name drop any apps, but there's been a significant increase in cyberbullying. So nowadays, face-to-face bullying is kind of almost non-existent, mm-hmm, compared to how it was before. It was the primary way that you would criticize or bully someone. Now the primary way is online. And again, among under 25-year-olds, about 65% report being cyberbullied or trolled at least 3 times in the last 3 months. So, I mean, it's happening all the time. You don't have to go very far on social media.
No.
Even on people who are, let's say, stage performers or, you know, bodybuilders, kind of weightlifters, if they're posting something, you know, there's a high proportion of people that just like to bring someone down. You know, an unnecessary comment to someone who's already
sensitive,
a bit anxious, wanting to look different, that comment could be that trigger that just sends everything into decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, one advice that I would give out to someone, if someone might be experiencing this, I have never, not never, but I've been on social media for 3-4 years, I might have received less than 5 really negative comments about my appearance.
Wow.
or any bullying or anything. But whenever I have received anything, I just blocked, mm-hmm, this person immediately.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter to me if they've followed me for a long time or not. Once a bully, like if they bully you once, they will try that again. So I would just immediately distance myself from them and block them and not even give them that access to me. So on Instagram, one good feature with Instagram, if you block someone, you also block every new account that they create. So for example, if you were bullying me from your fake account or personal account, and if I block that account and you create a new account,
yeah,
you won't be able to find me.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's something that is good. Yeah. So
that is really good.
Yeah. That's one good thing with Instagram.
It is, but you know, I've also had clients that I work with that haven't blocked the bully or the troll.
Yes.
You know, because they want to see how many negative comments they might get.
Yeah.
You know, they want to, it's almost their method of how pretty am I?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's count how many positive remarks I get and how many negative. But, and you can understand why, the negative always outweigh the positive, not in terms of the number of comments, but the power,
yeah,
that has over, you know, someone's self-esteem. One negative comment amongst 50 positive comments, the negative will always stand out to them.
Always stand out. I remember maybe a couple of months ago, I decided to start running. And I'm not a huge runner, but I said on my Instagram, I really want to start running and I'll share my runs. So maybe,
yeah,
this will inspire someone to start running because I can lift a lot of weight. I run a fitness business, but I said I'm very unfit.
Okay.
When it comes to like running distances and just cardiovascular health, I said that's something that I need to improve on. And 99% of the people said, oh, so I'm so excited to watch your journey, like you've, mm-hmm, inspired me, I'm gonna go for a run as well. And there was one person that messaged me from a fake account and said something in a sense of, oh, everyone seems to start running on social media right now, there's this other,
yeah,
influencer or other person who has also started running recently, like why are you trying to be like someone else? And from all the positivity that I received, that one negative comment, I was like, oh, like it made me a little bit angry. But then that also gave me an opportunity to work on myself because I said, you don't take that personally. Just either ignore it or report or just focus on the positive things and go,
yeah,
for your run and just enjoy your running.
For someone else that perhaps doesn't have the self-belief,
mm-hmm,
the confidence, that one comment could easily have shut down that whole idea. And they would have just thought, you know what, okay, yeah, someone else has done this.
Yeah.
There's no point me doing it. You know, so it's one comment can have such a huge, huge difference, impact on someone.
Huge, hugely. It's social media is a dangerous place. One of my clients, she is also a personal trainer and she works in a gym. So in the fitness industry, a lot of people feel this outside pressure to look a certain way because you are, I don't like this, but very often people feel like if you don't look a certain way, you won't be able to make any sales. No one will want to train with you. And kind of, I understand why people would feel that way and think that way, but there's a lot of pressure. So one of my clients has asked me, where's my question? I have so many. How to accept when you're not super lean? How to stop feeling like there are expectations of me and that I need to perform and look as an athlete and just enjoy my life? How would this person...
Well, I'd probably say, again, coming back to the fundamentals of what triggers or causes an eating disorder or even body image concerns, self-esteem is so crucial. So if you're someone who's a personal trainer is probably going to invest more of their, not just physical time, but kind of thinking time in things like nutrition, appearance. Like, it's quite natural. You'd expect that in that career. But I think trying to move away or to dilute how many thoughts, whether they're intrusive or not, your friend is having relating to, I should look a certain way, and trying to build up their self-esteem in other areas. You know, it's even just, they could do like a vision board or something like this, where they have five or six things on that board or piece of paper that they identify helps them to, kind of on a daily or weekly basis, be a method to measure the quality, their self-belief, themselves. So I would always say to someone who's got any struggles relating to these topics to understand what your methods of self-evaluation are, whether it's quality of being a wife, husband, daughter, son, nephew, the quality that I provide as a personal trainer, so my knowledge base. Because people, you know, you'll tend to find that people with heightened anxiety or sensitivity to the areas we're talking about today won't be using many different methods to evaluate themselves. And it becomes more and more focused on this one thing, being lean. I need to look a certain way to be able to promote my business to my clients or to be able to get clients to trust me. Fundamentally, that's not the case. You know, someone could have all of the knowledge to be able to guide someone on how they could change their physique or meet their goals without practicing what they preach themselves. Mm. You don't need to be, you know. And I think it's the same for most careers. But I do understand that within the fitness industry, there most certainly must be more pressure to look a certain way. Yeah. You know, if you say to someone, oh yeah, I'm a personal trainer, and you don't look stereotypically how they expect you to or the world expects you to, I can understand how that person might think, well, you might not be a good personal trainer. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you doing it yourselves? But that's more about the individuals that you're working with, I think. You know, if they have preconceived ideas about what a personal trainer should look like, I wouldn't take that as a self-reflection on how I should be looking. That's on them, if they think this. But I do also understand that the world, you know, there are stereotypical views about how we see things. And so for a personal trainer, you know, there's an expectation to look a certain way. But it's not a rule.
No.
It shouldn't be that way.
No. And having a six-pack won't make you any happier. I can tell you that for free.
Well, I mean, you as a, you know, very much a gym goer, personal trainer, bodybuilder. I mean, I have clients that tell me, I want a six-pack. And one of my first questions, if I've got a good relationship with them, is, well, how long do you want it for?
Yeah.
Because people who are performing or athletes, you know, especially within bodybuilding or other areas, tend to have breaks as well. They don't necessarily maintain I don't think they can maintain 8% body fat all year round. It's not healthy.
No.
Like, you wouldn't encourage that. So whenever, I mean, people say to me, clients say, yeah, but I want really like solid abs. It's always, well, how long for?
Yeah.
Because it's not sustainable.
Yeah. And why for as well? I mean, having a strong core is
Of course.
It's amazing. Supports your spine and your back to lift all those heavy weights that you lift and to train safely. But I was at that point where I could see veins on my stomach.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was very, very extremely unhealthy lean. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, like this is not sustainable. But also I was asking myself, I was like, why would maybe I want to sustain this long term? Because I know that it's not sustainable. So I was asking myself a lot of different questions. But then I think that opened my mind to what other people might be asking themselves, which also kind of, it not that it pushed me, but it maybe encouraged me to do what we're doing today.
Yeah.
Because I never had any negative thoughts about my body or anything until I went on social media, until I competed, until I lost a lot of weight, yeah. until I was showing the process of fat loss and using myself as an example. But then by the end of it, it made me feel like everything about me is just the mm-hmm. way that I look. Like there's nothing more to me as a person yeah. than my physical appearance. So
can I ask, Anna?
Of course.
In that situation where you, had this, you know, amazing physique or a ripped mm-hmm. physique, very, very lean, were you receiving more or were you receiving positive comments about it? Yes. Would you, if you reflect back, do you think you received more positive comments about your weight, shape or size, your appearance at that stage than you do now?
Yeah, 100%.
But not just about appearance, 100%. But even generally.
100%.
That's where the danger is.
Yes.
You know, you're going to get people that have their own body goals and they look at you and think, that's exactly what I want. And then they come and congratulate you, say, wow, like, how did you do that? This is exactly what I want. It feels good.
It does.
As an individual, doesn't it? I mean, we like compliments.
Yeah. I'm not ashamed to admit that.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
I would wake up and open my phone and I'm like, oh, let me see who replied to my Instagram story yesterday and told me that I look amazing. And then I've noticed that was something that I was expecting to see every day when I would every morning would open my phone.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, you need to know who you are with or without social media.
Yeah.
And
that's like a face.
Yes.
This is one of the faces that I have and it's kind of work, it's business, but who I am as a person and in my personal life is different. But they often merge together.
They do.
And, you know, when you're receiving positive comments and compliments, we want more.
You want more, yes.
Why not? I mean, it's natural. We like it. It's a boost to our self-esteem. But maybe something that you notice when you look back is that there just seemed to be a high proportion of the compliments that were relating to appearance.
Yes.
So then it becomes your method of self-evaluation.
Yeah.
That's the primary way my self-belief, my self-esteem, and my confidence is or has become determined because that's what people compliment me on.
Yeah.
Therefore, I need to maintain it.
Yeah. I've experienced quite a lot of things, but especially on social media. If I didn't get, I got so used to receiving so many compliments every single day, and then if I wouldn't receive as many as I received maybe yesterday or 2 days ago, it would make me feel like, oh, maybe something is wrong with me, or maybe I need to lose a little bit more body fat, or maybe I need to get a tan, maybe I need to, like, I would start picking myself apart because
what else can I do?
What else can I do? Yes.
Like,
yeah.
What else can I do to my hair?
Yeah. Everything was very heavily based on my physical appearance. Mm-hmm. And I used to get a lot of, and most of the comments and compliments were about my appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Now I rarely get them, but I have also deleted 99% of the content from the time when I competed because I didn't want. Back then, it made sense to me to post the whole process because I wanted to show people when you do nutrition right and when you do training right, you can change your body composition and it can be in a maybe up until like 4 weeks before you compete in a sustainable manner, calories in, calories out, carbs around your training, get enough sleep, you don't need any supplements, very normal, natural, give it time, trust the process kind of thing. And then after I competed, and when I kind of reflected and looked back, I was checking my Instagram page and I was like, wow, skin, mm-hmm. bikini. And I just said, I wouldn't want to maybe potentially trigger someone's body dysmorphia or an eating disorder. And I just removed all of the content from.
I can understand that. I think in society nowadays, we don't tend to compliment as much as we used to. And things like complimenting someone's appearance is really instant.
Yeah.
It's very quick to do. Whereas, you know, when was the last time that generally people would compliment on someone, you know, by saying, you're so kind,
mm-hmm.
or you're so caring, or you're such a good listener? Like, it happens, or it's likely to happen much less frequently. So then someone who has been receiving lots of compliments that say relating to their appearance, it would be quite natural for them to assume that's the only thing I can get mm-hmm. complimented on. But we actually just don't really compliment people. Like, we do, but
not enough.
It's more like a well done yeah. or praise rather than a yeah. compliment. But we don't, we're not a society, like, and I don't think a great deal has really changed. I don't think we've ever really been that society where you go up to people and say, you know,
what you're really doing kind. Is amazing. Yes, you're very kind. You're a very good chef, or your dinner was really tasty, amazing. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's
well, you know what? That's a really great example, yeah. Anna, actually. So you're in a restaurant and there's a lot of people that take photos of their food and post it. So they are drawing attention to how good it looks.
Mm.
That's not a measure of how tasty it is. So the chef might take something away from it if he happens to see that you've posted to say amazing looking dish. But is he going to get more from that, from witnessing that? Or if you ask to speak to him afterwards and say, look, your food was delicious. Yeah. Then he leaves feeling 10 times happier because you haven't just praised him for how nicely he puts things on a plate, but for how well he cooked it.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, what I'm always trying to encourage eating disorder or body dysmorphia clients to focus on. Try and get underneath this. If you're only focusing on the surface of how things look, it's going to be really, really difficult for you to overcome.
And I think it's very hard to break out of that maybe mindset or headspace where everything is just, everything about you is based on the way that you look. And people can often feel like, I have nothing else to offer to this world or mm-hmm. to the people around me.
Yeah.
If I don't look a certain way, or if I gain a little bit of weight, or if I lose more weight, like, everything is just purely.
And that's probably at the point already where they have an eating disorder, or they have, you know, a certain number of criteria for body image concerns. It's everything that happened before that led them to those types of thoughts. You know, it's not unusual for me to encourage clients to just lay low on social media.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot, and again, I think it's just a way of being now, but a lot of clients will spend a lot of time on TikTok and Instagram. And, you know, what they're looking at, when I've looked through their feed, because I often say, mm-hmm. can I have a look?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see who you're following. It's not all, but there's a lot of photos that relate to, you know, how someone looks, gym goers, you know, so they're the kind of people that they're exposing themselves to, often hours of each day. So I just say, limit yourself. 1 hour for each app will limit your exposure, which will limit how often throughout the day you're triggered. So that's something I recommend for for eating disorder or for people that are concerned about weight, shape and size.
Yeah, that's a great way to, that's a great thing to do. I have another question. How to manage your lifestyle without becoming controlling or obsessive about your diet and fitness? And I can speak from my experience, because when I first started going to the gym, I had no idea what I was doing. Then fast forward maybe 3-4 years later, when I decided that I want to compete, I became obsessed with learning. And then I became obsessed with applying everything that I've learned to myself and my body. Mm-hmm. So I would track every single calorie that I eat. I was weighing like 20 grams of spinach, which is, I don't know, 2 calories.
Okay.
Like 60 grams of mushrooms, which is, again, like, not that many calories, you know. Sugar, everything was sugar-free, calorie-free sprays, dressings, oil. It became very, very, very obsessive. What advice would you give to me if you knew me back then, or someone like me?
I think I probably have a question first. Okay. As someone with lived experience. So for you, is it possible to achieve, let's just say, greatness, mm-hmm. or what you really want to, without the obsessive nature? So can you look that way? Can you get down to having those abs with the veins, which on stage were probably useful?
Yeah.
Okay. So can you get that way without being obsessive?
Yes.
It's possible.
Yes, it is possible. To me, I think the way that my mind works was, if I do something, I want to do it correctly. Like, there's no room for error. If I'm going to use tracking my calories and macros as a tool, I will not miss and not track, maybe, like,
you're going to track everything.
Yeah, I'm going to track everything. I'm going to track my spinach. I'm going to track my 11 calories milk. Like, I'm going to track absolutely everything, because I don't want to leave any room for error. And then I was weighing myself at the same time every day. I was like a robot for six months. I would eat my first meal at 7:30, my second meal at 12, my third meal at 3, my final meal at 7 p.m., wake up at the same time, go to bed at the same time. I was literally like a walking robot for 6 months. And it helped in some ways, because to me, it kind of showed me that I can achieve anything that I set my mind to, which then, you know, I carried over to business. And if I start a podcast, I know that I can build podcasts. I know that I can reach out to a lot of people. I know that I can help a lot of people. So anything in life that I want to do, I know that I can do it. But did I need to go to that extreme and measure everything and become obsessed with measuring everything? I don't think so. I don't know.
Do you think it helped you achieve what you wanted to on stage?
On stage, yes. Yeah.
And that's the balance. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always really hard to find, because I think if you want to be the best at something, you've probably got to be obsessive in what you're doing.
Yeah.
So there's that element to it. And in many industries, that doesn't come with any health risks. You know, it just doesn't. You can be obsessive, where it comes with less severe, less worrying health potential issues anyway. But for someone who wants to change their weight, shape, or size, but doesn't necessarily want to win any medals, championships, or awards, I think, you know, I probably recommend not counting anything. Mm-hmm. I think fundamentally, you know, like, I think ideally, if you were to count, after a relatively short period of time, you would feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. And then you stop counting, because you've already got into a system of, okay, yeah, I know that it's roughly looks like this amount of mushrooms, and it's roughly this much rice. But I think it's really difficult. I work with a couple of dancers. They're always on stage, and you know, aside from some quite negative comments they've had from instructors in the past about you need to lose a little bit or you need to do this, you know, the reality is they're on stage, and they want to look a certain way, and they're expected to. So their dance regimes and their nutritional that they're consuming almost has to be at least somewhat regimented. It just has to be. But it comes at a big cost. And I think that's where the awareness really comes in. You said after about 6 months, it kind of, you had this realization of maybe this is excessive. Mm. Maybe it is obsessive, too much. And that awareness made you decide, do I want to continue this, or am I going to make a change? Like, can I soften this somehow? Yeah. Or do I do something completely different? So I think when we really, really want something in life, we tend to gravitate towards obsession. How to make it not dictate your lifestyle? I'd probably be more eager to hear from you, I think, with that lived experience.
Yeah.
Because for me, I could give you some practical steps, but everyone is so different. And, you know, I don't know what it's like to be on stage.
Yeah.
Or to perform, or to have that pressure. So I could say to you, you know, we just don't count or try not to count. But maybe that's not the reality, because there's probably a lot of people on stage that are counting. Are they counting safely?
Mm-hmm.
If so, okay, well, that limits risk. But, you know, for me, it's if someone is very, very dedicated to wanting to look a certain way, I'd hope they had something else as well. They don't have to be as dedicated towards that they're also looking to achieve. So whether it's, you know, to learn a new skill or to read more, you know, have something else that breaks up this method of how you're evaluating yourself, have another option. Because when this one fails, when the body appearance isn't maintained or doesn't get to the way that you want it to, if you don't have any other methods that are determining how you feel about yourself, your world crashes.
Yeah. I remember I was in my flat in London. So I think I put this maybe pressure on myself, or I just identified myself as someone who is tracking calories, is teaching people, you know, calories in versus calories out, fat loss, building muscle, gaining muscle. So my mindset was that everyone should track calories, which no one, like, you don't have to track your calories ever if you don't want to.
Well, it's also very time consuming.
It's time consuming. It is good to use it as a tool to learn, okay, maybe you think that, I don't know, this much peanut butter is 100 calories and it was actually 400 calories.
Yeah, so, good, you know, like, you
it can teach you a lot of things. But I remember identifying myself as a very shredded person that tracks calories, that is all about fitness, no social life, no, just very, very, I don't know, focused on that one thing, which was bodybuilding. And then a few months after I competed, I remember talking to my best friend Lewis, and I said, oh, I don't know if I want to track my calories anymore. And he said, then don't. Stop tracking. He said, why do you need to track your food? You know, he said, if someone knows about nutrition and, like, the amount of calories and the foods that you consume, he said, that is you. Like, you don't have to track your food. Just stop doing it. And I was like, maybe I just needed to hear, you know, someone else saying, just stop doing it. And then I just stopped the following day. I was like, just like that. Yeah. That's what I did with alcohol as well, because I was never a huge drinker, but the last time that I got drunk, it was at my, like, friend's wedding, and I just didn't like the way that I was feeling the following day. I was anxious, depressed, and I said, I'm just going to stop drinking alcohol, and I just kind of stopped. So that's my personality.
Well, that's great. I think for a lot of people, it's not quite that easy.
I know.
You know, they find it much more difficult. But I think, you know, even when you were talking about how your regimented kind of schedule became, I was just thinking, wow, this sounds really difficult to maintain.
Yeah.
It sounds exhausting, time consuming,
sad.
Draining, you know, to be measuring and weighing everything. For a lot of people, I would think it's hard for them to maintain, because it's like, well, this is a lot of work. But for someone who's perhaps extremely anxious about how they look, or very dedicated to wanting to look a certain way, it wouldn't be that unusual for them to kind of be open to that regimen.
Yeah.
But again, it comes back to, okay, where's the line? Where's the limit here? When I stop seeing my friends because I need to eat, or, you know, I can't go to my friend's wedding because it's going to mean I have to get on a flight and, you know, I just don't have time to prepare the food I need, or I can't, you know, weigh the food that's going to be served to me at the wedding. I think that's when maybe there'd be a bit more realization, like, oh, this has maybe actually become a big problem. Yes.
I had a moment like that, because I was so used to tracking everything. To me, it was just a habit. You know, you wake up, you brush your teeth, or you go to the toilet. Like, it was just very normal to me, a daily habit that I was doing for a very long time. And then I remember once, one of my friends asked me to go out for a dinner, and my first thought was, oh, but I don't know how many calories will be in this meal.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, okay, Anna, something is happening. I think you became obsessed with tracking calories. This is not healthy.
Yeah.
Stop doing it. So that's...
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen often.
I know.
That's rare.
I know.
I don't know if you've noticed as well, but on menus now in restaurants, yes. They've started putting calories.
They have.
Which I think can be a good thing, but I think it's also a disaster.
Yeah, and it's also not 100%.
Depending on who's reading the menu.
Yes, yeah. And it's also not 100% accurate because, you know, some chefs might like throw a little bit more oil, mm-hmm. some might throw a little bit less.
They're not measuring like you are, I don't think.
No.
To the millimeter.
No.
Or were, even. No. I think, you know, so even restaurants, you know, when you do delivery or takeaway,
yeah.
you know, I think McDonald's even has the number of calories per thing now, which again is good in some ways. But if someone is calorie counting, it's just another reinforcer to them of, we see, like everyone else in the world is doing it. This is normal. And then it just kind of normalizes it. So the risks just kind of go under the carpet.
Yeah. Oof. Do you have any, we kind of said like final words. What would you say to someone who might be listening, who is listening and who might be struggling with binge eating, eating disorder, body dysmorphia, but is afraid to speak out or to seek for help or to acknowledge, but like say it out loud to their friends or their loved ones?
I think that shame and embarrassment are probably two of the main emotions that someone might experience that would stop them from reaching out and speaking about it. Of course, I wouldn't recommend you speak about it to a stranger or to someone that you don't really trust, but a family member or a friend, you would hope that they're going to listen and offer support and guidance. You know, before we started recording, we were speaking a little bit more about the statistics and that the mortality rate for eating disorders is the highest across any mental health concern. It's about 17% of people that have had or have an eating disorder will end up dying as a direct or indirect result of it, and typically much younger than they should do, so an early death. So, I mean, it's not to scare people, but it kills.
Yeah.
It's the biggest mental health killer. You know, it's not just about the thoughts that we have about it, but heart attacks, you know, the esophagus, the throat just collapsing because you've been purging for so many years. The kidneys shutting down, you know, the brain developing problems because of it. So for me, like if that person has such thing like eating disorder or even traits, I would say it can often feel less embarrassing and shameful going to a professional because they don't know you.
Yeah.
They don't know your personal life, you know, and there's something quite special about therapy that you can feel close to your clinician, to your therapist, but you don't ever feel like they become family or a great friend, I don't think. And that's probably the way it should be. But I think, you know, the amount of children and young people, young adults that come to me and are able to tell me more in the first session than their parents have heard in the last 3 years, purely because I'm an outsider, because they don't know me. It's easier to almost talk to a stranger and hopefully a professional than it is to a loved one.
1,000,000%.
We're ashamed of it.
1,000,000. I always remember any time that I would travel and get on a plane, you know, like you always open up to that person next to you that you've never met and you will probably never see this person ever again.
Yep.
But I've overshared my thoughts, my feelings, my struggles. And then once you land and like you leave the plane, I was like, oh, wow.
But it's just bye, you know, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just bye. And I was like, oh, this felt so like
good
to let it all out. And I was like, if this person ever sees me again, they'll think that I...
Yeah, but you probably wouldn't have done that with someone that you see on a weekly basis. You know, there's the worries about judgment.
Yeah.
What if I have to see this person again? What will they think of me? So it's so much easier to talk to someone who's an outsider.
Yeah.
And if I'm being honest, I think what puts a lot of people off from sharing their mental health concerns or they have a concern with a loved one or a friend, is that often a friend doesn't know how to respond. You know, they might say something that they think is right, but it actually is taken wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so I've got a client at the moment who told her uncle that she wants to kill herself. And he said, why would you want to do that? You've got a great life. Well, she does. And he was trying to make her, I mean, she does in some ways. He was trying to make her have some kind of positive thought. He didn't do something wrong, but it probably wasn't the greatest thing to say because then she just felt guilty. Like, how come everyone else or so many other people in the world are struggling more than me, but I'm the one that wants to die? So it had a negative, more negative than positive. So people don't know how to respond a lot of the time. You know, if you go to a friend and say, I'm feeling really down, really low, that friend 70% of the time might say, you know, pick up a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, or go out and do something that you like. That's not what the person wants to hear most of the time. They want to hear someone say, oh, tell me a little bit more about that. You know, to be curious so that they can open up. Yeah. But that often doesn't happen. So I think if you are going to speak to a loved one or a friend, there's a slight risk that they just won't understand, you know, or they won't know how to respond. And that might put you off going to see a therapist. Yeah, it could do. Whereas when you go and see a therapist, often after about 5 minutes, the client just starts pouring out what's going on, you know, just because it's that safe environment.
Yeah, they feel safe to talk to you.
Yeah.
Because they know that you don't want to say anything to anyone else, but you also won't judge anyone about anything, and you are there to help.
Yeah, it comes without judgment.
Yes.
So I would say seek support.
Yeah.
You know, it, as I said at the start, it often eating disorders and body image concerns, if they're at the point where they, where there's diagnosable, they're unlikely to go away on their own.
Yeah.
It's possible. You know, if you believe in miracles, it's possible, but most likely it won't. So I'd get help for it. Absolutely.
Oh, I could talk about this forever.
Yeah, it's one of those topics that's so relevant to the world and what's going on.
Forever. Well, you have, I think your assistant said that you need to leave it at 10:20.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so I'm going to wrap it up. But I could honestly talk about this for like...
It's that kind of topic where it just goes on and on. And I think that's what places it as one of the highest risk.
Yeah.
Because it's so deep. There's so much depth to what causes, what triggers, what maintains weight, shape or size concerns, body dysmorphia, whatever it may be. There's just literally hundreds of causal factors, thousands of maintaining factors. And so many ways out of it or to try and come out of it. But also so many holes that can bury you in it, which is why an eating disorder treatment typically ranges from 6 to 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of general guidelines that I would give to a client if they meet a diagnosis. And to be fair, I don't typically meet with clients who are in crisis eating disorder. It's either remission, emerging traits, or they just about meet the criteria, but certainly not with anorexia. And not without the guidance of a psychiatrist, probably a dietitian or nutritionist, a GP to take regular bloods as well. Like, it's just one of those mental health concerns that's so complex, so complicated, requires such speciality and really to know how to help your client. There's a lot of people in Dubai that I know of that practice eating disorder treatment. Just not eating disorder therapists.
Yeah.
You know, they've done a 6-hour online course.
Yeah.
You know, they're therapists, they're psychologists, but they've done a 6-hour online course in ED or eating disorder, and then they start practicing it with clients, and you're thinking,
like, what are you doing?
How?
Yeah.
Can you even do that?
Yeah.
The riskiest of all mental health concerns, you're meeting with them and you've got 6 hours of training. Not all. There's loads of great ones in Dubai.
Yeah.
You know, some really, really top eating disorder specialists, but there's just a lot of very average or poor as well.
Yeah, it's the same with personal training.
Yeah, I'm sure. Any industry, I suppose, anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But it's hard here. And eating disorders, it's just one of those mental health concerns that's the trickiest. You'll read that everywhere. The most difficult to treat. Again, it comes back to denial, you know, resistance. You know, there's a lot of like CBTE or like enhanced CBT for eating disorders maintains a lot of family therapy, which is really necessary to overcome, but not necessarily at the start, but somewhere through the mid or towards the end of the treatment, or for at least family to be very inclusive in the practice itself, what's going on, just because whatever happens at home, the dynamics, it's so, so important, you know. And If you speak to different therapists about it, you'll get different avenues of treatment kind of plans and modalities. Some will say that, don't force the child or young person to eat. So don't sit them down at the table and make them sit there until they finish. More traditional types of eating disorder treatments will say, no, that's going to happen every meal.
Mm.
You know, and they can't leave until they finish. So there's definitely different pathways to treat it, but it's just so complex that it's really difficult to treat.
It's really difficult. So reaching out to a professional is always the best thing to do.
I would say so. Have an initial call.
Yeah.
A lot of centres in Dubai will give you an initial 20 or 30 minutes kind of free consultation over the phone to see if they've got the right skill set to work with you. And perhaps can just give you some guidance as well. Mm-hmm. As long as you pick someone who's good and ethical and cares, I would say they'll give you the right advice to get you started.
Oh, this was so, I wouldn't say refreshing, but a very, very emotional to me, because I know how much people who follow me have been excited for me to do this and just to ask their questions. I still have another probably 20 questions that we could talk about, but we might keep that for another occasion or for some other time. But
absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for coming on here today.
So welcome. Thank you so much for having me. I really hope whoever hears or listens to this finds it useful, gets something from it, even if it's one thing. Yeah. For me, that's job done.
Job done. I will make sure I'll attach the website.
Excellent.
I was going to say downstairs in the description down below so that people can check out you and your work and your clinic. And
if they want to speak to me,
if they want to speak
of course,
to you, yeah.
even just to get some advice,
yeah.
more than happy to.
Thank you so much.
So welcome, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.